The following message is a presentation of Ligonier Ministries, home of the radio program Renewing Your Mind with R.C. Sproul.
In our study of the providence of God, we have looked already at the concept of chance as it relates to the providence of God. And we have said that if God's providence is real, then nothing ultimately can ever happen by chance. We recognize that there is real causal power in this world. If I pick up my book, I am a causal agent exercising secondary causality, but I can't pick up this book in front of me unless the providence of God permits it. Because ultimately, all causality is based in and flows from God Himself. And if we really have that understanding of God in our minds, then we have to come to the conclusion that ultimately there's no such thing as an accident. Now, we use the term accident to describe events that take place that we did not intend to have happen. My wife last year was hit in the side of her car by a truck driver at an intersection. We called it an accident. I don't think the truck driver, with malice aforethought, had an intent in his mind to ram into the side of my wife's car with his truck. He didn't mean to do it. And since he didn't mean it, and my wife didn't mean it, and nobody else apparently meant it, we call it an accident. But we still have to ask the question, where is God in all of this? Where was God in the accidents that you have experienced in your life? On September the 22nd, 1993, my wife and I were involved in an accident that we will never, ever forget as long as we have memories. In the evening of September the 21st, being on our way from Memphis, coming home to Orlando, we had had a stopover in New Orleans. Late that night, we boarded a train in the station in New Orleans. The name of the train was the Sunset Limited. We got on the train in the last car in the sleeping compartment and immediately had our bunks turned down and we retired for the night. Comfortable, peaceful, assuming that on the morrow we would reach our destination and be home. But everything changed without warning, and suddenly, in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, I awoke flying through the air, a human projectile, experiencing the law of inertia. You know the law of inertia, that bodies at rest tend to remain at rest unless acted upon by an outside force. And that bodies in motion tend to remain in motion unless acted upon an outside force. Well, what had happened was the train crashed while it was going 70 miles an hour. Now, when you're in a vehicle that is going 70 miles an hour and it stops, you continue to go 70 miles an hour. And so at 3 o'clock in the morning, I was awakened flying through the air at the speed of 70 miles an hour, and I was in a new state of inertia, a state of motion, and I was going to stay in motion until something stopped that motion, and what stopped that motion was the wall. And I hit the wall, bounced off the wall in the pitch dark amidst the screeching noise of metal against metal, and I had this instant realization that obviously we were in the midst of a wreck. But as all these things are taking place in the intensity of the moment, the first thing that came into my mind, and was the same thing that came into my wife's mind, is she all right? And we both cried out to each other in the dark, "Are you all right, honey?" She assured me that she was fine, and I assured her that I was fine, and then our brief conversation was interrupted by the screams of a woman in the next compartment who was screaming that she was bleeding and that she couldn't get out of her room. And there was a banging on my door and on her door by the cabin steward who was trying to see how many people were injured. And I got out of the cabin and into the hallway and helped the cabin steward get the woman's door open next door. And she was not fatally injured by any means, but she was very frightened. And now my assumptions changed. When we first crashed, I assumed that we had been involved in an accident at a crossroads, that the train had hit a vehicle. But now when I walked out in the hall and looked out the window, I saw this gigantic ball of flame that must have been rising 50, 75 feet in the air outside of my window. Now my thoughts were these. I thought, oh, we must have hit a tanker truck, an oil tanker or something. I still wasn't sure what was going on. And people had popped the windows through the emergency windows out and wanted to climb up and jump off the train. But the steward said, wait a minute. We're 25 feet up in the air and we don't know what's out there on the ground. There's no need for that. Just be calm and we'll go out down the stairs, because we were on the second floor of this double-decker, and out the back of the train. And so we were able then to get everything out, all the people off our car, down the stairwell, and out the back of the train. And they immediately herded us away from the back end of the train, and we could see that the flames were moving along the roadbed on both sides of the train cars coming in our direction. And so what train officials were there herded all of those people well beyond the back of the train. And in a few moments, I circled around and came back towards the back of the train to see what was going on. And now I could see that this was not a crossroad accident. But I could see, almost in grotesque fashion, in surrealistic figures, the flames and the fire and the smoke. And there was also a situation in the morning in the bayous there of intense, deep ground fog. And I could see that there was a searchlight of some kind that I later learned was the searchlight of a boat, the boat that had actually caused the accident by hitting the railroad bridge. And we saw the rays from the light sort of coming through the fog, and the light was refracted because of the smoke and of the fire. But silhouetted against this backdrop of flame and of fog, I could see two train cars in the water. That's all I could see. One of them with its open end sticking out of the water. And as I stood there and watched it, suddenly a ball of fire just went through that train car and out the empty end of it, like a funnel, like fire in a funnel. And my immediate thought was, if there's anybody still in that car, they have no hope. What I didn't know was that even underneath that car was another car submerged on the bottom of the river, where almost no one had survived. And so we came back and sat down on the tracks. And we were huddled around with groups of people, a large number of whom had been cast into the water by the train wreck and had managed to swim to shore or were rescued by those on the riverbanks. And they were wrapped in blankets, and everybody was trying to help everybody else get comfortable as we waited for rescue. But the accident had taken place in the middle of a remote part of Alabama. There was no access to the site by car. There were no roads. The only way in was by rail, and in this case it was a single track, not a double track. And the only other way was by air or by water. Now, about a half an hour went by, and we began to hear the sounds of a helicopter, and the helicopter came, but it couldn't land still because the flames were so high and so intense. But it shone a searchlight on the water so that if any people were still trying to survive the accident, they could be spotted in the water and rescued. And the tugboat captain and his crew actually rescued about 17 people out of the water. We were told to remain where we were, and finally, after another half an hour or so, a train approached us from the rear, and we experienced this sense of finally we're going to be rescued. But the train stopped and sat there and sat there and sat there. And finally, it just backed up and left. And we had no idea why. We later learned that it was a freight train. And when it came upon the accident, it radioed back to Mobile. And the people in Mobile already knew from the Coast Guard messages that there had been an accident. They didn't know the severity of it. They had assembled all of their rescue crews there in Mobile, prepared the hospitals, had gone into their catastrophe alert program. And they had assembled 400 rescue people on a train to bring them to the site. But they couldn't bring the train in because the freight train was blocking. So they had to wait for the freight train to back up all the way back into Mobile and then start the rescue train in so that it between the time of the accident and the time the rescue train arrived, it was 3 hours. So we sat there on the tracks, you know, talking with people, trying to just be as optimistic as we could be. And finally, the rescue train came. And a certain preliminary triage was implemented by which those who were injured most severely went to the closest car, and those who were safe and relatively unhurt walked along the sharp rocks of the roadbed and went to the final car on the train. And that's what my wife and I did. Vest and I went, and we boarded the last train in the car. And I don't know how many people were on that car, but those were the people who were the least injured. And then we had to go backwards in that train over the bay and back into Mobile. And then that took us another hour. And during that time, two passengers on our car had heart attacks just from the trauma of all of this. And there were people sitting around me shivering in blankets, you know, and talking about this horrible tale of having been thrown into the water. And I talked to one young man and his wife. She was sitting there, teeth were chattering, her feet, she had bare feet. I gave her my socks to keep her feet warm. That's all I could do to help her. And the fellow explained that they were in the car that was at the bottom of the river and that he had 5 seconds to escape and that he kicked the windows out and pulled his mother and his wife through the window and to the surface and were able to swim to safety. And we were hearing story after story like this from the rest of the people. But there was no panic. There was no mob violence. People were working together in this situation. And we knew that it was obvious that there had to be some fatalities. But nobody knew that this accident was the worst accident in the history of Amtrak. That this accident killed more people than all of the fatalities combined in the history of Amtrak. We didn't really realize that until we came back on the train into Mobile. When we arrived in Mobile, the sun was just now coming up. And we looked out and there was literally over 100 ambulances with all of their lights blinking and so on there at this intersection where they had gathered to meet us. And again, another kind of triage took place. People who had had heart attacks, people who were wounded, were carried off the changes and off the trains and put into ambulances and taken to the nearest hospital. Then we saw body bags taken off and delivered to the morgue. And we were placed on a bus that would take us to the furthest hospital because we were the least injured. And again, it took another hour before we got to that destination. And when we arrived in front of the hospital, we were absolutely amazed because there must have been 100 people standing in front of the hospital, all the administration, the doctors, the nurses, and rescue people there to meet us as we came to the hospital. The name of the hospital, friends, in Mobile, was Providence Hospital. I couldn't help but notice the name of the hospital. And we were treated with great tenderness, great compassion, great kindness, and gone through medical checkups and all the rest before the people were released. And I couldn't wait to get to a telephone, because I knew by now that the enormity of this accident was such that certainly there had been bulletins that my family at home would know about. And when I called, I felt like Peter coming at the door when the people had prayed with him and they shut the door in his face because they thought it was Peter's ghost. When I called, I discovered that Bob Ingram, one of our vice presidents, and my son had already left for the airport to fly to Mobile, not knowing whether they were coming for bodies or to bring us home. And so we got the message to them that we were okay and that we would meet them at the airport in Mobile upon their arrival. And so we came home. and began to see that this thing had national publicity. And I was besieged by newspaper reporters and television people who wanted to do interviews, and they were sticking microphones into our face and asking about this horrible event. But when I reflected on it afterwards, the thing that struck me was the questions that they asked. They asked me, in many cases, inane questions, silly questions. But the one that they asked me most frequently was, "Why do you suppose you were so lucky? Why do you think your life was spared and 47 other people's lives were taken? Don't you really feel lucky?" And I said, "Well, no, I don't feel particularly lucky. Maybe I would have been lucky if I would have missed the train. That would have been lucky, not to have gotten on there. But I don't consider these kinds of events matters of luck. I know that my life was in the hand of God. But weren't the other people's lives in the hands of God?" And I said, "Absolutely they were." I heard all kinds of stories later. I heard the story of one couple, father and a mother of some people, who met some friends at New Orleans. They were in the sleeping car, and their friends did not have a ticket for the sleeping car, and so they moved out of the sleeping car and went forward into one of the cars, and they perished. How lucky is that? And they said, "Well, why did you live and somebody else didn't?" I said, "I don't know. Maybe tomorrow God will take my life. He could have taken it tonight. But I know that that night was not my time in the providence of God to die. But it was the time for other people to die. Because that train, rushing at 70 miles an hour, out of control, once the bridge collapsed and there was no track for it to run on, was not out of the control of God. The engineer had no control. The tugboat captain had no control. The passengers had no control. But the hand of God was there. And as hard as it is for us to deal with that, you know, I think it's much more optimistic and comforting to know that my life and my death are in the hands of God." Somebody else asked me the question, "What did you learn about this theologically?" And I said, "I could give you a pious sounding statement. But if I'm going to be honest with you, I really didn't learn anything. Because I already knew that my life was in the hands of the providence of God. I already believed in the providence of God before this accident took place. Now, I learned something existentially. I learned something experientially. My doctrine was confirmed, obviously, through the reality of this situation." And I said, "What I found out in spades is that you're never safe. Belshazzar wasn't safe when he thought he was safe. I wasn't safe when I thought I was safe." I said, "But I also found out paradoxically, though not contradictorily, you're always safe. That is to say, from a human perspective, you're never really safe. But from a divine perspective, if your life is in the hands of God, you're always in a situation of perfect safety. Even those who perished, perished by the hand of God safely. Because my ultimate security, my ultimate safety, does not rest in the plans and the provisions that I make for this world. But they rest in the provisions of God. And if it's God's provision that my life is to end, I would much rather understand that it's in His hands rather than to assume that I am a victim of blind, impersonal forces over which neither God nor man have any control whatsoever. I don't mean that God reached down from heaven, grabbed that train, and threw it off the bridge and into the water. I don't mean anything as crass as that. But if I believe in God, and if you believe in God, you have to believe that the invisible hand of God was sovereignly involved in the Alabama train wreck. Because God's providence extends where human roads don't. It extends into the night. It extends into the bayou. It extends into the darkness. It extends into the flame. It extends into the wreck. It extends into the wreck of your life. And it extends into every accident you've ever experienced. Because we believe that God is a God of providence. In our Coram Deo thought for today, let me ask you to think a little bit more about this whole idea of cause. It's basic to our vocabulary. When somebody asks a question, a child asks you, why does such and such happen? We just give the brief shorthand answer, because. When we say that, we are saying that there is something that produced this result. And what we've been trying to see here is that though there is such a thing as cause and effect in the world in which we live, all power ultimately rests with God. And so that God is the supreme cause of everything that comes to pass. He doesn't necessarily do it directly or immediately. He may and often does work through the causes that are found in this world. But still, even His sovereignty extends over all things. Now, causes are important for us. We need to know why the grass grows and why the grass dies. We go to doctors to find out what's causing our pain or what's causing our discomfort or our illness and so on. We are constantly in the realm of science trying to penetrate the real causes, but normally we stop our gaze on the surface. We look at secondary causes. The Christian needs to go deeper and look behind the temporal causes of this world and see the invisible hand of God's providence.
For more information about Ligonier Ministries, call 1-800-435-4343 or contact us on the web at ligonier.org. That's ligonier.org. Or write P.O. Box 54, 7500, Orlando, Florida, 32854.